It was electrifying.
Electrifying. Yeah.
Hi, David Nguyen here for our third episode of the Mobility Podcast. I'm here with the Gregs, Greg Rodriguez and Greg Rogers, and let them introduce themselves. So,
hey everybody, this is BB and K Greg, the lawyer they finally let in the room, talking all things mobility and trying to help us navigate the sticky legal situations that come up in a world of automation, and hopefully making sure that we take advantage of technology to promote and enhance public transportation for all.
Hey, y'all. This is Greg Rogers, or Eno Greg. I'm the assistant editor of Eno Transportation Weekly and a policy analyst at the Eno Center for Transportation, where I focus on finding sound policies for autonomous vehicles and research potential solutions for regulatory issues we'll be facing in the near future for autonomous vehicles.
And our traditional legal disclaimer, all views are our own.
Yes, that. And Pete Gould is going to chime in from an undisclosed location. So with that, we will go ahead and turn it over to Pete for the Hyperlane headlines.
Hey guys, it's Pete Gould here. Looking forward to being back next week in the studio with you. So here we go with this week's Hyperlane news highlights for your mobility news nerd enjoyment. Our first story may have a familiar ring, so stop me if you've heard this one before. New York City finds itself at odds with a rogue shared mobility provider again, and the New York City DOT has issued a cease and desist letter to block the company from launching in the city. No, we're not talking about Uber this time, or even another TNC. This time, the city's battle is with the dockless bike share company, Spin, which is hoped to launch in the city this month, but that now appears to be up in the air. In our next story, Tesla, according to an August 15th report by Reuters, Tesla is developing a long-haul electric semi-truck that can drive itself and move in platoons that automatically follow a lead vehicle. And the company is getting closer to testing a prototype. And that's according to an email discussion of the potential road test between the car company and the Nevada DMV that was seen by Reuters. Meanwhile, California officials are also meeting with Tesla to, quote, talk about Tesla's efforts with autonomous trucks. That's according to a California state DMV spokesman. Lastly, Continental Group, the automaker and or the supplier and the giant in the auto business that has been increasingly active in its pursuit of leadership of the emerging autonomous vehicle market, recently acquired Singapore-based Quantum Inventions for $29 million. The newly acquired firm is nearly 10 years old, but has increasingly been focused on smart cities technologies, including work that the company has done in Singapore, where its technology has been used by the government, which is developing a new satellite-based electronic road pricing system, which handles tolls, parking, and other fees, and is designed to ease congestion. So keep an eye out on that. There's many more stories, as we've told you, to make sure you go and check out our website, www.mobilitypodcast.com, and in the Hyperlane News section, we're going to be updating those throughout the week. And if you catch stories that we've missed or you want to make sure that we're aware of, please make sure that you shoot those our way and flag them for us on Twitter. Our handle is @mobilitypodcast. Now back to the Gregs and David.
Thanks, Pete. So moving on to our next segment here. I'm going to talk a little bit about electric vehicles, specifically that battery electric vehicles seem to be the technology roadmap that various car companies are converging upon, as well as the different regions in the world. So the other part of this, of course, is, well, what about fuel cells, hydrogen fuel cells specifically? And so I'll start off here. Let me just talk a little bit about what's going on with the vehicle manufacturers. In North America, or the North American manufacturers, GM, they've got the Bolt that's out now, and it's a dedicated electric vehicle platform. Ford seems to be somewhat undecided in that they have a number of hybrid electric vehicles coming out, and also some plug-in electric vehicles as well, but none on a dedicated platform. They're all based on existing vehicle chassis. And then, of course, Tesla, which is all battery electric vehicle. And then there's FCA, Fiat Chrysler. And they do not seem to have any plans for an electric vehicle that we know of. So it's looking more and more likely that the rumors of a buyout or a takeover of some or all of their brands is looks like it's gaining momentum.
And this is for Fiat Chrysler, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So this has kind of been an ongoing story for Fiat Chrysler because they've tried to be acquired a few times, and now I believe that their founder and CEO is, or is it just the president CEO, who he's about to retire by, I think, early 2021, 2020 or so. So it definitely makes sense. Could you explain maybe a little bit more about what the difference is between lithium-ion batteries in terms of electric vehicles? And like you also mentioned hydrogen fuel cells, right?
Yeah.
What are the significant differences between those?
Yeah, so battery electric vehicles are I think people are pretty familiar with the concept. It's just a battery. You know, different chemistries that can store more or less energy. But
right, it's the Energizer Bunny, right?
Yeah.
Just put in your car.
Yeah, you plug it in and it goes. Hydrogen fuel cells, the way they work at a very high level is basically you're combining hydrogen and oxygen to produce electricity. Mm-hmm. And then the resulting emissions is simply water vapor, you know, mm-hmm. combining it, you know, it's H2O. The challenge with the fuel cells is that you have to store hydrogen. So you have to produce hydrogen and you have to store it in a way that is going to allow a vehicle to actually do useful work, right? So
and be safe.
Yeah, right. That too.
Is that whole volatility thing that comes with hydrogen.
People have a very long memory about the Hindenburg, but there's other challenges. You know, it's the main problem with hydrogen. Yeah, it's fairly easy to generate that, but to store it is really hard. The benefit of hydrogen is that it has about, you know, three times the energy density per mass of gasoline, but it's not very compact. So like you need a very large volume to store compressed or liquefied hydrogen, and the problem with that is that, you know, hydrogen is like the smallest molecule. You know, so it's actually really hard to store because you can generally think of any container that's holding it, especially under pressure. Like we're talking really high pressures, like 5-10,000 psi.
Wow. So we're thinking, Terminator, when liquid nitrogen opens, very cold, freezes the Terminator, shoot it, blow it up. That's what's going to come out of the tank.
Well, that's nitrogen, right? But hydrogen has similar ideas. It's really, you got to keep it cool.
Same thing. Look, it's cold.
At atmospheric pressure, regular pressure, its boiling point is -253 or so Celsius. So it's a very difficult thing to work with. It takes up a lot of volume, and then you're not going to be able to move a vehicle easily for 300 miles. You know, the range is a problem. And other than that, it's great. Like, I've driven a fuel cell car before, a Honda Clarity, and it drives just like any other electric vehicle. It's nice and smooth, but yeah, like the hydrogen is a hard thing to obtain and transport, store and transport. And then, where are you going to get more? So I think in the entire DC area, there used to be, it may still be there, but there's only like one hydrogen refueling station.
Right.
And then on top of that, your range is limited. So That's much harder than even the idea of plugging in your electric car at home.
And the interesting thing here is that we've been talking about hydrogen vehicles for decades now, electric vehicles too, but now we finally have the infrastructure, it seems, to put electric vehicles on the road and put enough of them on the road for people to feel comfortable using them.
Do we really have the infrastructure to support all these vehicles going electric? I think we're going to get to that, but before we go there, can we think about you know, the other benefit too, in addition to maximizing energy, is the environmental benefit, mm-hmm. like you said. So, I mean, I think it's fantastic. Everybody's saying that only water is going to be emitted from a tailpipe. That's very attractive when you're thinking about greenhouse gas emissions and improving the environment, which is why I think then we're now talking about potentially electric vehicle and thinking about, because I think that is one of the moves that's causing the industry to pivot, is also thinking about how do we make sure that these vehicles are clean and do realize all the environmental benefits around vehicles.
Yeah, I think one of the things about hydrogen and fuel cells is that, and this is not necessarily polite, but there's a joke that goes around that something to the effect of, you know, hydrogen fuel cells, you know, the fuel of tomorrow, and it always will be, and you know, so far that's kind of been true, because like this has been a known, you know, technology for a long time. It's just how to do it is really hard, and so I think many of the people involved are looking at it sort of like battery electric vehicles in the shorter term, and then, you know, fuel cells in the longer term. But it doesn't look like, you know, there's a whole lot of promise with the hydrogen as of yet. Mm. And while that continues to be, you know, in the R&D arena, the battery electric vehicles are here on the road. You can buy them, of course. They're about 1% of the new vehicle market, light passenger or light vehicle market. So there's a fair amount of them, and we see Teslas, especially around here, quite a bit. And
here being Washington, D.C., yeah, of course.
Washington, D.C.
And the amazing thing, too, is that already the Tesla superchargers are all across the country, and they're in these amazing sort of routes where you can go. I mean, you can go coast to coast, but you can plan pretty much any road trip that you want if you think ahead and do it.
Although, yeah. Has anybody noticed that where they're located within some malls, they seem to be located very close to the entrances where arguably there should be handicap spots?
Really?
I've noticed that trend. So next time you're driving through a parking lot in a mall that has a Tesla store, I kind of look and I'm like, wow, those are the prime parking spots, which is interesting. I mean, there's nothing wrong with buying those, but then it gets to the whole equity piece around all this that we're thinking about.
Right. For those who are listening, actually, if you see any of these, tweet us at Mobility Podcast, and we'd like to take a deep dive in this later.
Yeah, take a picture, sure. And say, wow, is it really as close as I'm saying, or am I just completely off because there was an eclipse, hence the music when we started off today.
And so to circle back to your thing about the environmental aspects of it,
yeah,
you know, I don't know about the hydrogen side of things. You know, what it, depending on how it's produced, and again, same thing with the battery electric vehicles, right? How is the electricity produced? If it's, you know, whether it's coal, whether it's solar, whatever the source. So that's one part of it. But whatever the source, it's flexible, right? It can be adapted. Mm-hmm. So maybe right now, a larger proportion of it is coming from a coal-fired power plant, but in the future, that builds in the, you know, adaptability to change to other sources that make sense and they're maybe more environmentally sound. But also the production of these vehicles and the disposal of vehicles, and specifically with the batteries, right? The recycling and what do you do at the end of life cycle of these things? That's a big thorny question, I think, that doesn't get a whole lot of or as much attention as it could. Now, specifically with batteries in cars, one of the things that happens is while they may no longer be useful in a car, you could put it for stationary use, right? Like in a house or like a power bank or a Tesla makes, or, you know, for backup sources for buildings.
Can I just put it in my fridge and make sure it keeps? Isn't that how you keep batteries safe?
You know,
just put it on ice.
Yeah. Don't tell me my grandma was wrong. She said to put them in the fridge.
Well, let me just ask you this. You know, how much energy does it take to keep that fridge running to keep the battery cool?
I'm not asking for details. But I think your point about the landfill is very good. And we've started talking to some of our clients at the municipal level being like, okay, this is great, but it goes to the planning around this. Are we thinking about, you know, how are we going to dispose of this? I mean, right now we don't even have a policy for disposing of nuclear waste, which is coming up year after year after year. How many times are we going to hear Yucca Mountain and go back to it, just like the Raiders are going to Vegas, but that's a whole different thing. But it's how are we planning to dispose of not only the batteries, but then when we, you know, I hate to keep circling back to automated vehicles, but you're essentially going to have a computer in a trunk and a hard drive.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't think most people even know how to dispose of their computers and things like that. So no. Even though there's environmental benefits from an emissions perspective, there are the trade-offs, which I think that you're getting at.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know what they do with cell phone batteries right now, but think about this, right? An electric vehicle is going to have how many times the batteries of a phone, and then how many fewer vehicles are sold relative to phones, and then you can sort of figure out like how many more batteries are we going to be in need of recycling or disposing of, and then on top of that, the different materials that go into these, like lithium. I don't know much about it, but I think that there's a lot of mining of it that goes on in places like, I think maybe Chile or South America, Bolivia, somewhere in South America. And what happens when the demand is higher, if the demand gets higher than the supply, or it starts to put pressure on the supply?
Right.
I mean, the one thing that really struck me is that I think of the guilt that I feel when I take two AA batteries out of a remote and throw it in a trash can. I can't imagine what that would be when you...
I can't believe you do that.
I can't believe you would admit that on air.
I don't actually do that.
Those go in the drawer next to the refrigerator.
And you wait for the next roommate to throw them out.
Next to the old cell phone.
Along with the keys that you don't know what the keys go to.
Right.
The extra keys.
But circling back to reality, I think, you know, so I think this is a great discussion. Where do you see this going with the rest of the vehicles being produced across the world?
Yeah, so let's just run down this little list I've got here. Basically, we talked about North America earlier. In China, I don't know the specific numbers, but I think at a high level, 1% of their market is also new car market is battery electric now, or electric in general, and that's a much larger market than the U.S. It's the world's biggest market. I think 28 million units last year. Germany, in Europe, you've got Germany basically. That's the big vehicle producer there. The Volkswagen, Volkswagen, Audi group. BMW, Mercedes, they all have a lot of EV programs going on, and they're also under investigation. Some of them are under investigation for things like Dieselgate. So I think diesel's kind of waning because of some emissions challenges on that technology, and also cost, because it costs more to make a diesel engine.
And especially the fact that I believe it was France and the UK both passed laws recently to where they're not going to allow internal combustion engine vehicles to be sold after something like, what is it, 2035, 2040, something like that. I mean, there's the market push, but there's also sort of this political push. There's this environmental concerns that's really pushing us more towards EVs or hydrogen vehicles tomorrow, of course. Maybe it'll always be tomorrow, as you said.
Yeah, it's to be determined. You know, the thing about those rules, and I think at least France, maybe Britain as well, is that I think it will allow for hybrid electric vehicles with internal combustion engines, but not vehicles solely powered by ICEs.
Right.
But also at the same time, we got to think back to, like, I think it was California around like 1990, they had all these like projections or plans for, you know, electric vehicles taking over the fleet.
But David,
there.
Who killed the electric car?
I can't tell you because I haven't seen the film. But the main thing here is, like, we still have, you know, ICEs as the predominant mode of automotive transportation. Mm-hmm. Other things about Europe, Volvo, which is now owned by a Chinese company, has announced that in 2019 they'll start with only hybrid electric or electric vehicles. And then, you know, in Asia, you've got besides the companies in China, you've got Toyota, Honda, Nissan. They all have electric vehicles, and specifically Toyota and Honda have made a notable shift. Also, from Korea, Hyundai, they've made a notable shift from pushing hydrogen fuel cells to battery electric. Toyota's going to open a plant in China. This probably has a lot to do with the Chinese government's push for battery electric vehicles. They're shifting and more of their attention to that, and I think they're keeping a foot in the fuel cell developments for probably for the longer term, maybe hedging and also perhaps to save some face.
And then sort of on the home front, Toyota and Mazda decided to partner up on this new factory in the U.S. to work on electric vehicles, and there are some hints that they're going to be focusing on AVs as well. Sort of because, and I think, you know, one of the parts of this is that electric vehicles are sort of the future. It's being market driven, it's being policy driven, but from a technological side as well, autonomous vehicles are going to have electric vehicles in most cases, because the computers require a whole lot of voltage, wattage. You're the engineer, I'm not, but to actually power the computers. So it's interesting to sort of watch all of these things kind of converge at once. And they all seem to be pushing each other forward.
Yeah, there's the thing about Mazda that's interesting is that they didn't have any electric vehicle plans either, and that's one of the big things about this tie-up with Toyota. Toyota's sort of buying into a lot of the the second tier Japanese auto manufacturers, and Mazda, their focus has always been, as far as the last 5-10 years, on the holistic view of optimizing the vehicle design as it is today. I mean, using the technology that we basically have today, which is lighter weight, more efficient engines, transmissions, that kind of thing. But yeah, no alternate sources of energy, fuel, and so this makes sense for them.
But that's a zoom method. We'll just call it that, right? Well, it's smart branding. But also, I mean, you think about what happened with the hybrid vehicles and how they came about. Toyota developed a technology. Ford just kind of waited and then bought it.
Yeah, exactly. but Toyota is clearly the market leader.
Right, but why not? What, so from Mazda's perspective, why go invest a bunch of money trying to develop a technology that you know someone else can already be the leader on, and then partner up or just jump on the coattails of them?
Yeah, well, I think that's what they're doing, because they're in a similar boat with the Fiat Chrysler. They just don't have the scale. Right. So they couldn't put the resources towards the kind of things that Toyota did. Toyota, I mean, I think they had been developing the Prius since like 1983.
Wow.
And like they put like a dozen years into it, you know. And I think GM probably had some program like that, I had read, and they just didn't have the long term, ability to stick with it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's what I think we're seeing in the marketplace. The things are converging on battery electric vehicles, and that with your points, Greg, about autonomous vehicles and AVs. Yeah, the future, I've heard this repeated many times, is electric, connected, and autonomous. Mm-hmm. And the thing about it is, you may have seen this commercial, TV commercial years ago, where they were like, it was like, what if everything was powered by gasoline? And it was like your toaster, your lawnmower, your cell phone, And that's sort of like what would happen if you put if you tried to make autonomous vehicles out of conventional, gasoline powered vehicles. Digital technology is what's going to enable all of this autonomy and connectivity, and so it just makes perfect sense that things are moving from a mechanical or analog type of technology towards digital.
Great. And hopefully they're shared. I think we have to throw it in, but that's an asterisk whether or not the vehicles would be shared, and we'll be riding in them in a shared use way. And then just to throw out a shout out to Mr. Musk, Greg, Greg's favorite person. Let's think about potential roads with solar panels and solar panels on top of cars.
I'm opening a window to jump out of right now.
And then that gets to another discussion we'll have later on about the infrastructure to support this. Do we have it, and how do we get there?
Is there sunlight in tunnels?
I'm going to leave it at that.
I think if we were to go down that road, it would bore you a little bit, so we don't have to.
Oh, got it. Joke. I like it. Man. Well done.
All right. So, yeah, that pretty much wraps up the EV discussion. And now I'll turn it over to BB and K Greg, who's going to give us his take on how we got here with regard to federal automated vehicle policy.
All right, everybody. So breaking news from last Friday, August 18th, is that Secretary Chao and the Department of Transportation sent what is hopefully revised policy, and hopefully not too revised policy, of the federal automated vehicles policy for review by OMB. So this, I think, was an interesting move on a Friday, and some people picked up on it, perhaps sooner than others. Kudos to Greg for tweeting that out and getting everybody into the loop. But we want to do just a quick rehash for those of you who may not know that there even was a federal automated vehicles policy. That was introduced in September of 2016 through the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, affectionately known as NHTSA. And there were the policy was broken up into four parts: vehicle performance guidance, the model state policy, NHTSA's current regulatory tools, and NHTSA's tools and authorities think from the perspective of how can they be changed or improved. I'd be curious to see if that's what they focused on, or whether or not there was more focus on the vehicle performance part, which is that part one that had the dreaded safety assessment letter discussion, and whether or not that is voluntary or mandatory. So that triggered a lot of discussion, and that's something obviously in the current House bill, which has been made mandatory with an asterisk, as we talked about in our last podcast.
And so these safety assessment letters in the guidance, this is for manufacturers and tech firms to fill out whenever, in order to ensure that, or rather in order to prove to NHTSA that they say their vehicle is safe. And it's really sort of more of like an on the honor system sort of thing, from what I understand.
Right, which goes with the whole process of how vehicle safety works, is kind of a self-certification process. But the key difference here that we've kind of honed in on a couple times is that usually there's some sort of minimum federal standard with regard to safety. We don't appear to have that with regard to automated vehicles, as again, as we've discussed. But moving along, I think we're all curious to see what that update has in it. From my perspective, I'm hopeful that it doesn't go too far or potentially eliminate the model state policy section. I mean, in the private industry, I'm sure they wouldn't mind seeing that go and moving more towards the complete preemption that we've been talking about. I don't know if Greg has anything he's heard with regard to it very quickly or...
Yeah, one of the things that I've been told on background by a few sources is that this new version of the automated vehicles policy, first of all, is meant to sort of be a... I believe Secretary Chao, the way it was told me, Secretary Chao was asking staffers to find something, anything, to change from the Obama-era automated vehicles policy. One of the things that's always been a question is a safety assessment letter. But as Greg mentioned, what was sent to OMB was actually, it was, so we don't have many other details other than the fact that it's a voluntary automated vehicles sort of guidance for manufacturers. So what we can take out of that is that there will be something. We don't know what it's going to be in there. But also I'm hearing that they're considering in this new version of the FAVP actually removing maybe the third and fourth sections of it, which are on NHTSA's authority as it stands now and NHTSA's requested authorities for that Congress could explore, which would essentially mean that they're handing the reins over to Congress on deciding whatever they want to do rather than asking Congress for it. But again, this is all hearsay at this point. This is from folks off the record and on background. So
yeah, and I just, Greg, for those in the room right now, just saw me shudder at giving everything to Congress. And not that I don't trust Congress, but it is concerning when you're thinking about something so complicated being taken out of the hands of the agency that's in charge of regulating safety. But just taking a quick step back, I think most people would probably agree that what the current version of the Federal Automated Vehicles Policy is pretty balanced. It ended up being 112 pages, I believe, with the version that's in front of me right now. And I just wanted to give a quick history of how we got here. And I think it starts with that March 1st hearing in the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee on March 15, 2016. For those of us that were watching, it was a pretty interesting conversation. I think you saw senators starting to get involved. My biggest takeaway from that I tell the story today is Senator Nelson, a former astronaut, talked about being nervous about being in a Tesla and trusting a technology when it took a turn quickly and actually accelerated in a curve like we're all supposed to do, but we don't as humans because it seems scary or it's difficult to accelerate in a curve. But at that hearing, you had somebody from Google X, which no longer exists, now that's Waymo. And then you had others within the industry. You had Lyft Government Relations. And I think it was very interesting. You had Dr. Mary Louise Cummings from Duke University in the robotics department. I think that is, watching that hearing, I saw kind of a pivot to say, wow, these vehicles aren't as safe as industry is making them sound, which I think then led to a 112-page federal automated vehicles policy as opposed to a two-page document, or maybe what's the current page count on the House bill? Is it 36?
It's around 30 pages or so, yeah. 36, yeah.
Or let's just say a very pared down 38 page document that's rather industry friendly.
Yeah. But if I may, one of the interesting things about the FAVP when it came out is that in the years before that, NHTSA was really trying to advise Google and other folks on a case by case basis how they're being regulated. And I believe it was 2011, 2012. Google wasn't sure if their vehicles would actually comply with motor vehicle safety standards. Even though they had more or less everything else in there that would be safe, And this is an interesting part of like the motor vehicle safety standards is that Google was concerned that their brake pedals actually would not be considered to be compliant because there wasn't actually going to be a human foot pressing on them. But what the NHTSA folks actually did was they said, well, the way that the brake pedal part is written is that there has to be X amount of force applied on the brakes in order to deal with it, in order to actually make the vehicle brake. You have to prove that. And they said, you can do that with a robot too. But the interesting thing here is that all these manufacturers are trying to figure this out, and this goes to what Greg is saying, is they're trying to relieve some of the uncertainty around this. And the fact that the Senate called in, you know, the big guns, the guys from Google and Lyft and folks, and had this hearing, and it was one of the very first, I believe. It was either them or Energy and Commerce.
Yeah, no, this was the first one, March 15th.
Yeah.
So on that, I'm not going to go through every single witness, but I want to give all the dates of every single hearing so you all can go back and take a look at the witness list and see the trend that I've been talking about is, you know, there's no city witnesses and nobody from transit, which I think is a little bit disturbing when you're trying to talk about the long-term potential benefits and making sure these vehicles operate safely, hopefully complementing public transportation.
These are the people managing the roads and the buses. Why do we not have them there?
Right. So we had that first hearing again, March 15th, 2016, in the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation. Then you had the Disruptor Series on the House side in the Energy and Commerce Committee. That was November 16th, 2016. Then you had another one in the House, the Energy and Commerce Committee, entitled Self-Driving Cars, The Road to Deployment. Then you had another one on the House side that was March 28th, 2017, where they talked about the different levels of automation.
And no member did their homework. It was an absolute disaster.
We'll leave it at that. And then you had, which I thought was kind of like Groundhog Day, we had another hearing in the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation. So the tone and conversation of the June 14, 2017 hearing was perhaps less robust and not as in-depth as the March 15, 2016 hearing. It was just interesting to me. I mean, we had a whole year, more than a year go by. We had a federal automated vehicles policy go out. We had a notice and comment period. And it seemed like nobody had really invested the time and effort to say, how do we actually make this happen from a policy perspective? And that's what kind of circling back, what concerns me about giving the reins over to Congress. There's a lot going on in Congress right now, if nobody's noticed. And we're going to have a lot going on this fall. And so we're going to have hopefully another notice and comment period on the federal automated vehicles policy. And it kind of questions whether or not we should be going down the path of regulating these vehicles and having legislation that may be too prescriptive. And just then to finish it off, we had the additional House hearing June 27th related to the proposed legislation. We had the subcommittee markup in the House on July 19th, 2017. And then the infamous full committee 54-0 bipartisan passage of H.R. 3388 on July 27, 2017.
Also called the backslapping bonanza.
But, you know, I think I want to end it on the tone of collaboration, which I think we've all been promoting. And even though we talk about how cities haven't been brought in to testify, how transits hasn't brought in to testify, I just think we still are at this point where we have a golden opportunity. And our point of these conversations and to point out the facts around what's been happening is to try and say, hey, these are potential points where we're omitting important people from the table and not inviting them in. How do we get more collaboration as opposed to what we're about to talk about right now, where we're talking about banning automated vehicles in cities like Chicago?
Okay, now with our legislative update, we've got Eno Greg to talk about the House and Senate autonomous vehicle bills and other happenings.
All right, well, there was some concern on the Hill as the House and Senate AV bills first started to move that if they didn't get this done by the August recess, then it would get mired in a whole bunch of controversy. People would dig in. We'd end up in sort of this World War I of policy fights.
You're not even talking about just the White House.
No. But all around, I mean, this is exactly what we've seen over the recess. So the House Energy and Commerce bill for automated vehicles is called the Self-Drive Act, as Greg mentioned earlier, is built around these sort of ideas of allowing manufacturers to deploy AVs sort of across, or test AVs across the country, and it creates sort of certainty for them to do it. But a lot of sort of concerns have emerged around preemption, or the P word, as we discussed in our last episode, in that there are a lot of cities and counties and states that are concerned that language in this bill would stop them from regulating how automated vehicles are actually put on their roads and how those sort of how they shape the rules of the road.
And lead to potentially large amounts of litigation based on vague language, specifically the unreasonable restrictive language.
Right. And this is one of the biggest issues, is that there is this sort of provision that said, you know, a state or a city cannot place unreasonable restrictions on how AVs are operated. And there's a lot of questions going around as to whether, you know, a city can say, I don't want AVs operating around school zones or in construction zones. We don't know what an unreasonable restriction is. So there are a lot of issues sort of from the cities and counties and state perspective. They're all pushing back on these bills. And the Senate bill, which was not introduced before the recess, as was anticipated, now seems to be grinding to a halt, both because of issues over the preemption language. And then the Teamsters have started to raise concerns that the automated vehicles will cause sort of the erosion of human driving jobs. And so they lobbied actually that for regulations around trucks that are automated should not be put in place yet. This is, of course, not just a challenge from a political perspective in terms of opposition from the Teamsters, but it's an optics perspective. Because see, the biggest thing here is that we need to understand is that in speaking with truckers and truckers associations, one thing I've constantly been hearing is that in trucking, you often have a shortage of jobs. What is it, like 50,000, David? Is that what you said earlier?
Yeah, it seems to be perennially 50,000 drivers that are needed and not available, especially in good times economically, because they'll do other jobs.
Right, and unemployment is at historic lows, but we're still having that issue. And part of that is because being a trucker is just, it's really hard work. You are constantly responsible for driving, but also for making sure that your goods are loaded and unloaded. You have to watch over the vehicle. And so actually automating the process of driving could improve these jobs in a lot of ways and could make them more attractive. You can do yoga in the back of your truck, for example.
Wow. Never thought of that.
This is something that a trucker told me. I'm not saying we're going to have a whole bunch of trucker yogis out there, but that's all you've been hearing. But the opposition for the Teamsters really communicates this fact that there is more concern over how automation is going to impact workers. And this has always been an issue for, you know, 60 years now. JFK, as I've said again and again, proposed the first job retraining program around automation and globalization. And 50 years later, we're still having a lot of these same conversations. So it's a complex issue.
And it's an important issue, and it's good to be having the conversation. It has to be had. We can't plan around the future of transportation without planning around the future of jobs. It should just be a part of every discussion when we're talking about technology and innovation.
Absolutely, and this is one of the things that at Eno we did some research. We did a couple of research papers around sort of what federal, state, and local authorities should be doing to help encourage automated vehicles to be adopted safely, but also what they should be doing to ensure that their workforces aren't just completely devastated by automation. And one of them is create grant programs, start partnering with the universities, start talking about these issues.
And even are the cities of tomorrow ready for the jobs they're going to need to make sure they're regulating these vehicles? I mean, I think about source code and things like that. I think that's an opportunity for the public and private to be working together, mm-hmm. potential internships to help cities understand the code that might be needed for the future, especially in a connected environment when you have to make sure that the code is consistent when the vehicles are talking to each other. And that's way above my head, but
right.
To notice any sort of anomalies in the code, which may mean there's either an issue or a potential hack going on.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I mean, when we're looking ahead, we need to be sort of trying to figure out how will we actually allow AVs to be operating safely? How will we sort of work on this convergence of connected, automated, electric vehicles, and are we going to make sure they're shared?
And David, tell me, it's just going to be a world where we have binary numbers, just like the Matrix, and I'm going to be sitting in my office and just picking out numbers, and that's pretty much how I should prepare myself for the future.
I mean, who's to say that you'd still be sitting in your office?
This may be happening.
I don't know.
This actually may be happening right now, and we're in the Matrix.
I think this is an Elon Musk theory, isn't it?
There was an eclipse today, right?
There was an eclipse today.
But let's take this back and go to this point of, so maybe what's the right approach, wrong approach? Because we've heard about the city of Chicago in 2016 having an ordinance talking about potentially banning automated vehicles from operation. And I think there's some undertones there with regard to labor, potentially taxi cabs, all these issues where are we having the right discussions with them to make sure that, you know, those jobs aren't going away immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And are those jobs going to still be around in the future anyway? Kind of thing about trucking. Are those jobs that younger people even want?
Mm-hmm. And what jobs are going to be created, right, as a result of the adoption of new technologies?
Exactly. And one thing that I always like to try and bring us back to is the fact that as a taxi driver, as a truck driver, you know, as a bus driver, you're doing a lot more than just driving the vehicle. Bus drivers have to collect fares, have to make sure everyone feels safe, and truck drivers have to make sure their goods are being transported safely.
Efficiently and safely.
Right, and the taxi drivers, I mean, you can sort of think of, I mean, for whatever, you know, sort of way that they've been posed in a lot of situations, they often sort of seem like the veins of a city. They're the ones traveling around, they see the most of the city, they're most embedded in it.
And they know the city on the back of their hand without looking at a phone to figure out where they're going, which arguably makes them the safest driver in the city.
Exactly. And I mean, when we look all at all of this in total, I mean, just to put a little bow on this, I don't think that the jobs are going to go away in 10, 20, 30 years, because we're going to need people to be overseeing AVs, and we're still a ways away from being able to have fully driverless vehicles in all situations. But this Chicago example is interesting because Chicago met on the day that we're recording. August 21st? Chicago's city council met to consider banning driverless vehicles, or actually rather autonomous vehicles. There are a few things here that are issues with it. Number one, they don't actually use the Society of Automotive Engineers as actual definitions of what an autonomous vehicle is. So there is definitely some strange leeway in interpretation issues. But it's a blanket ban on autonomous vehicles, which, you know, is certainly something that we could consider a city being able to do and being able to... we just paused for a picture. Stand by.
Selfie.
But the issue here is this, is that cities aren't always going to want to have autonomous vehicles on the road. And at least right now, until federal action is taken, cities can do this, unless they're preempted by the House and Senate laws that we mentioned earlier, should they actually pass. But the interesting part on sort of the advocacy end is that Consumer Watchdog and Consumers Union have really been starting this massive campaign against autonomous vehicles. And they're constantly citing the lack of, you know, real information about disengagements of the automated system. And they've constantly been a force of opposition, but rarely really propose solutions to make sure that AVs are operating safely. And the press release that we actually saw today was one of the most substantive things I think that we've seen yet, because they actually recommended doing something similar to how California's AV laws work. I do just want to bring this to everyone's attention. One of the city council members in Chicago, and I'm quoting from an article here, warned that the city council needs to ban the automated vehicles to prevent someone as crazy, quote unquote, as movie character Doc Brown, inventor of the DeLorean sports car time machine in the Back to the Future film trilogy, from endangering the public. If we allow ourselves to devolve to the rhetoric of they're going to be just mad scientists creating time machines, I mean, why don't we just say that there's going to be, you know, by having connected vehicles, we're leading ourselves into a Terminator situation?
We are.
Well, that's what some people say.
But I think that's a good point. And I think maybe what's lost in a good example that was communicated badly is the safety side. How do we make sure that somebody isn't going to go rogue and put some sort of crazy vehicle on the road that isn't safe?
Yeah.
I think this comes back to your point, Greg, about these hearings and such not having necessarily all the parties and all the stakeholders at the table.
Right. I mean, yeah, think about law enforcement. I haven't seen anybody from law enforcement testify at any of these hearings yet.
Absolutely. And I mean, moreover, the reason that that Chicago even proposed this ordinance is because the Illinois legislature, the state legislature, is considering a bill that would preempt cities from saying that they can't that you can't operate an AV within their boundaries. And so now we're in sort of this Russian egg doll of an issue. The city wants to make sure that their streets are safe. They haven't been included in these conversations. And then, you know, you put another egg doll over it, which is that the state is trying to preempt them. And then there's another one. It's the fact that the federal government is still kind of blundering their way through this issue, and not really including cities and states in the first place to actually resolve a lot of these.
And I think what makes it challenging too, from a legal perspective, is you have the federal government and the federal automated vehicles policy, and even the legislation coming out of the House trying to preserve the traditional powers of state local governments versus federal. And you see that if you look at the ordinance in Chicago, and it's you can find it online, but it was introduced on 9/14/2016. You have an ordinance that's preserving local traditional police powers. And it's very similar to the legislation that you see Senator Feinstein introducing in the Drone Federalism Act, which is kind of dealing with these same issues. How do you preserve local government traditional police powers around ensuring public safety, around ensuring the public welfare, versus not wanting to hamper innovation and trusting the federal government to get safety right? And that Feinstein Drone Federalism Act is S-1272, currently pending in the Senate. And it goes back to our overarching theme here of what role should federal government have? And in my opinion, and I think my cohorts here agree, is that it should be promoting the safety and taking a leadership role around the safety issue and making sure we have some sort of minimum standards for safety. And it doesn't have to be just one. Can be tech neutral. I love that word out of the Senate bipartisan principles, because we're not trying to prescribe the technology or say this is the only one that works, but we want to make sure that there's minimum safety around the technology that's being put on our roads.
And I mean, this is really the big issue, is that when we talk about preemption in the first place, the reason that preemption was a favorable way to make sure that we are regulating vehicle safety is because the federal government was taking action. Granted, not as fast as maybe they should on several issues, including seatbelts and recalls for airbags that might have been defective and might have been, you know, killing people. But the fact is that overall, federal motor vehicle safety standards have been enforced and created to do a lot of the great things that have allowed us to see less and less deaths per miles that we travel. And we can't really have that without an active federal government that's funded and resourced properly in order to do so. And so I definitely see where the cities and the states are coming from, because, look, of course they're concerned. It's taken a long time to have any policies that make sure these vehicles are safe and this technology is safe. But, slash rant off, stick a fork in me, I'm done.
All right. And with that, I'll just mention this little anecdote. I saw a comic, I can't remember where exactly, so I can't cite the source, sorry. But it's a picture of a cop pulling over a motorist, and the line is, "Does your car know why my car pulled it over?" And with that, we'll go ahead and I'll talk about our little patent stroll for the week, or this episode.
So are we going under the bridge to meet you as a patent stroll, or like how are we?
What was that 80s song? 7 years under the bridge.
Red Hot Chili Peppers.
No.
That's one thing.
Yeah, there was one with that.
Let's go with that one.
Okay.
Cool.
Quick hat tip to Riley Brennan's Future of Transportation newsletter for bringing some of these patents to our attention. So we have two patents that were granted, one to Amazon and one to Waymo, and then a patent application from Ford that was published. The first patent from Amazon, the title is Ground-Based Mobile Maintenance Facilities for Unmanned Aerial Vehicles. It's a bit of a mouthful, but it's a pretty neat idea. Essentially, what we have are little automated mobile warehouses in the shape of an intermodal container, and then inside there's some inventory that is predicted to be ordered as a vehicle that carries this container travels along some route. So it's either a train or a truck or even possibly a ship, but most likely a train or a truck. And this container has aerial drones in it, and they are loaded with the inventory as the orders come in, and then they're sent out to make their deliveries, and then they come back to the same container, but by then the container's at a different point. So this patent involves all the linking and syncing of the movements of both the vehicle that's carrying the container and when the drones are sent out and when they come back and where they come back to. Also, inside this this container are facilities for changing the batteries of the drones and also making certain repairs, examples being a replacement of electric motors or propellers. So that could be pretty interesting. You know, you've got these little warehouses now. They're totally automated, and they're getting closer and closer to where the orders are going to be delivered. So the second patent application or patent that was granted here is for Waymo, and it's for, the title is Reducing Surface Rigidity of a Vehicle. And what this is that you've got a number of body panels on a vehicle, like the hood, bumper, fenders, that sort of thing, that can be made to soften up prior to a collision with either a bicyclist, pedestrian, or an animal, some sort of vulnerable living creature. And how this works is that the panels are held on to the vehicle with cords or cables that are in quite a bit of tension to hold the shape of the panel. And then right before a collision, the tension is either reduced by somehow releasing the cables a little or just cutting them. And then what happens is the panels are able to absorb more energy and hopefully reduce the crash severity for those people or animals outside of the vehicle. And also the vehicle is able to detect what's around it and then when a collision is imminent, and also determine which panels are most likely to bear the brunt of the impact and therefore soften those panels. So very interesting case here, because most of the time historically vehicle safety has been about crash survival of the occupants. And in the last several years, there's been a movement towards crash survival for people outside the vehicle, like pedestrians. And even though we're moving rapidly along this continuum of active safety, you know, things to help prevent crashes like automatic brakes and lane departure warning systems, and ultimately to autonomous vehicles or self-driving vehicles, this is an acknowledgement that there is still a need in the long term for preventing reducing injury as much as possible when the crashes can't be prevented. In other words, crashes will still happen. Hopefully there'll be a lot fewer of them, and then also the severity will go down. And then finally, we've got a patent application that was published from, it was Ford's application for something called a removable steering wheel and pedals for autonomous vehicle, which pretty much says it all. What it is you've got a vehicle that is able to operate in more than one mode, autonomously and with a human driver. And so in the mode where it's operated by a human, you've got a steering wheel and pedal assembly that can be basically plugged into the car. And interestingly enough, seems like it could be either side. So whether it's in a country like the US where we drive on the left side, or the driver's on the left side of the car, or in countries where you have right-hand drive, or maybe postal vehicles, you can have the steering wheel and pedals on either side of the car. And the one of the key points here is that the airbag is going to be inside the steering wheel for when you have a need for it, you know, if there's a collision while it's being driven by a person. And then there's another airbag that's in the dashboard that is presumably needed if there's somebody sitting in that seat when the vehicle is operating in autonomous mode and there is a collision. So either way, if somebody's in the seat, they're covered, they'll have an airbag. And then the other thing that this tells us is also that, this implies, it doesn't explicitly say so, I don't think, but these things, the steering wheel,
I mean, the steering, braking, and throttle are going to be drive-by-wire in the future. So right now, you know, drive-by-wire, where there's no physical cable between the throttle pedal and engine controls, is widely used already. But we're continuing to move down this path of the all-digital vehicle instead of mechanical things like steering columns and steering racks that are physically connected.
And that's a wrap for this episode of Mobility Podcast. You can find us on the web at mobilitypodcast.com, on Twitter at Mobility Podcast, and you can send fan mail or hate mail to mobilitypodcast@gmail.com.
If you send anything about the Boring Company, I will block you.
Or solar panels.
Or solar panels.
Or just send hate mail in general. And also, if you want to send a message or follow any of these individual co-hosts here.
BB and K Greg, you can find BB and K Greg. You can find me at Smarter Transpo.
And for Eno Greg, you can call me. You can find me, fittingly, at Eno Greg R, E N O G R E G R, on Twitter.
I'll call you, maybe.
Please.
And I'm David Nguyen. You can find me at Dave Nguyen, DaveWin, as in November. And you can find Pete at Pete_Gould. That's G as in George, O-U-L-D.
Is that O as in octopus?
As I can't believe this. Octagon? Are we going to play board games now? Yeah, I was always
terrible. O as in this is over.
Over, yeah, over. We're done. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back with our next episode soon.
Thanks, guys. Bye.